Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 4th of November 1923, Bona Law dies. But first, some of the other stuff that's caught my attention this week. There's been rioting in Freiburg, 13 people are reported to have died. There's been rioting in Berlin, and the German government has told the communist Saxon government that if it doesn't do what it's told, it will send in the army. In Munich, Adolf Hitler has claimed that we are going to march on Berlin. I saw this in Friday's In Brief column. Frederick William Maximilian Jesse, 26, was executed at Wandsworth Prison yesterday morning for the murder of his aunt, Mrs. Mabel Jennings Edmonds, at York Road, Lambeth, on July the 21st. That was how it was done in those days. On a more positive note, I found this in the very same column. The Lord Mayor of London acknowledges the receipt for the Mansion House poor box of £105 being the proceeds of the sale of some jewellery sent to him by an anonymous donor, XYZ. There's been some discussion about the broadcasting of Parliament. They're only going to have to wait 55 years for that to come about. There's also been a correspondence on the subject of unintelligible English, with the suggestion that the BBC should do something about it. Which of course it will, which is how we got BBC English. This week brought the news that Andrew Bona Law, who had been forced to resign as Prime Minister in May due to ill health, had died. On Wednesday, the Times published what it called a memoir of Bona Law's life and times. The death of Mr. Bona Law removes from the political stage, if not one of the greatest, certainly one of the best-loved figures in our parliamentary history. Indeed, the House of Commons has had few more successful leaders, and he will be remembered not so much for his brief career as Prime Minister, as for the important part he played as a member of the Cabinet during and after the Great War. But he was the first Prime Minister, as Mr. Baldwin was the second, who had the qualification of a career in business. I'm trying to think of any subsequent ones, without much success. I'm now trying to think if it makes much difference. Having made his money as an iron merchant, Bona Law entered Parliament in 1900. Few men have made their mark more quickly. His first speech, a reply to an attack by Mr. Lloyd George on the conduct of the South African War, attracted attention, not only by its argumentative power, but by its exhibition of his extraordinary gift, conspicuous throughout his career, for dealing with a complicated series of facts and arguments without the assistance of a single note. But the press gallery was not equally complimentary, and in later years he would tell the story of his disappointment, when conscious of his success, he looked to see what the newspapers would say of him, and got no better reward for his trouble than the remark that the debate was continued with characteristic dullness by Mr. Bona Law. The Conservatives lost power in 1906, and in 1911 Bona Law became their leader. This was at the beginning of the Irish Home Rule crisis. The big issue at stake was what would happen to Ulster, which was predominantly British. And in July 1913 he said, in a speech at Blenheim, that he could imagine no lengths of resistance to which the Ulstermen might go in which he would not be prepared to support them, subsequently declaring in Parliament that these words were deliberate and had been written down beforehand. Strong stuff. I might point out that at the time the Ulstermen were, well, they were forming their own army, and later on they formed their own government. Just at the moment Ireland appeared to be about to descend into civil war, the First World War broke out. In 1915, the Conservatives, slash Unionists, went into coalition with the Liberals, Bona Law eventually becoming Chancellor. The courage with which he enormously increased the already colossal taxation imposed by his predecessor must be held one of the causes why this country was so much sooner able to balance its budget after the war than countries which had relied altogether on loans and scarcely added to their pre-war taxation. This is something I've seen elsewhere. Against this may be set the fact that he was thought by good judges to show more courage in imposing taxation than in resisting expenditure. I think this is unfair. In a war, especially one of national survival, you spend every penny you can get your hands on. However, there are criticisms that are more justified. The ministry decided to appeal to the country directly after the armistice, and to make their appeal as a coalition, though most of the Labour ministers resigned, and the Labour Party had their separate election programme. Bonar-Law joined with the Prime Minister in issuing a manifesto to the electors, which was completely successful in winning the election, but had disastrous results when it was won. It sounds a lot like he was bamboozled by Lloyd George. There can be little doubt that its general suggestion of a new heaven and earth after the war came rather from this somewhat shallow optimism or from the electioneering instincts of Mr. Lloyd George than from the Scottish caution and common sense of Bonar-Law. The truth seems to be that having always in very full measure the average man's admiration for success, he had been carried away by that of Mr. Lloyd George and allowed himself to join in promising to the country a sort of golden age, when if he had sat down in a cool moment, he would have been the first to recognise that the post-war age would at least in its beginnings be much more like an age of iron. Hopes had been raised which had to be disappointed, and the process of disappointment was at once dangerous and expensive. Eventually, Bonar-Law decided enough was enough and led the Conservative Party out of the coalition. A general election soon followed. Instead of a flood of promises, there were no promises at all. So we have a Prime Minister promising the earth and then failing to deliver, eh? Sounds vaguely familiar. A Prime Minister promising the earth, failing to deliver, and being ousted from office and being succeeded by a very short-lived replacement. That sounds very familiar. Referring to Bonar-Law's family life, it says this. Two of the sons were killed in the war. By my reckoning, that means that the leaders of Britain's three largest parties in 1914 all lost at least one son in the war. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.